And this is Bergen Amateur Radio Association Technical Net. Are there any stations on frequency with emergency or priority traffic? Please call W2TTTK2BAR. Okay, nothing heard. Are there any stations out there? Well, actually, yeah, we did that already, sorry. Okay. So the purpose of the technical net is to have a conversation about amateur radio, electronics, telecommunications, all sorts of wonderful things out there that might be of interest. So we are interested in having that conversation. You can talk pretty much about anything related to those elements, as they are related to amateur radio or things we do with it, and the technologies and natural phenomena that support it. So, with that in mind, we have a structured check-in process. That structured process starts with your call sign, your name, and then we indicate whether we have a question, a comment, both, or none of the above. So that's how this game is played. So, let the games begin. Stations whose call signs begin with the letter Whiskey, please call K2BAR.
W2JEK, Don, none of the above.
Okay, Don, very good. Thank you very much. Any other stations with a Whiskey call?
Connected CX6CAH.
Let's take that call, CX6CAH. Welcome to the Bergen Amateur Radio Association Technical Net. Please give us your name and where you're located. Over.
Good evening, Gordon. This is Matt 13, I then realized that I have my other call sign on the Echolink, so that's what you heard of. I'm here in San Diego, California. How are you? KD2AKB.
Okay, very fine. KD2AKB. W2TTT. Very good, Nestor. Good hearing you. Very, very nice. All right. Welcome aboard. Well, I'm out of, are there any other Echolink stations on the net tonight before we move on? Any other Echolink stations? Alrighty, that was easy. Are there any other, stations with Kilo 2 calls? Let's do the Kilo 2s next. Please give your call sign, your name, and indicate whether you have a question, comment, both or none of the above.
AC2NKU, Maryland, White Plains, no questions, no comments. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening, Maryland. Any other Kilo 2s?
Kilo Charlie 2, Tango Echo Lima, no questions, no comments. Just checking in.
Kilo Charlie 2, Tango Echo Lima, good evening to you. Your name, sir?
My name here is Bob, Bravo Oscar Bravo.
Okay, very good. Kilo Charlie 2, Tango Echo Lima, welcome. Alrighty. Any other kilos?
2 AMI, Tony. 1.
I doubled with somebody. Tony, will you have questions or comments?
One question, a simple one, and one comment.
Yep. Noted. Any other stations? Hello.
This is November 2, Oscar Echo Lima. One question.
Okay. Good evening, Noel. Any other kilos?
This is K9BA, over.
K9NBA, Joe. Good evening. Would you have questions or comments for the next?
No questions, no comments. It's a pleasure to work with you at Clay County Fair.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure to work with you as well, Joe. It was a lot of fun. Thank you for coming and helping. Any other kilos? Okay, Jim, good evening to you as well. Any other kilos? Okay, you've got a bunch of newbies out there. That's good. Or relative newbies. Alrighty. How about November stations? Someone checked in on 444.1. You want to try that again?
W2CH, Ray, none of the above. Good evening, Gordon.
That's better, Ray. I think you came through on 440. Yeah, I was listening on 444.1. That's hysterical.
Oh, yes.
Okay, no problem. Anybody else for the kilo? Anybody else for the November? Anybody else for the whiskey?
Whiskey 2, Juliet, Charlie, none of the above. All right.
Hello, hello. All righty. Good evening, Jim. Yawn, yawn. All right. Any other, any alpha stations? All right. How about anybody else, any call signs?
WE2R, Charlie, with a question.
Okay, Charlie, very good. All right, well, let's get to it. I think that's about it. Are there any other stations checking in real quick? I'd like to welcome some of the new stations who haven't, or stations who haven't checked in a while. That's really great. And let's get to it. So, K2AMI, you're first with your announcement or question or comment or whatever it is. K2BARW2TGT.
Gordon, first, I have a very simple question, and that is, I know the Bergen County FM Association has a repeater up in Franklin Lakes on the 146.79 frequency, but I've forgotten the PL tone. Do you know the PL tone of the Franklin Lakes repeater up there?
I do. It's 162, whatever it is.
That's question number one. Comment is that we just got a notice here that this coming weekend is the New Jersey CUSO party, and the members of Barra are encouraged to look at the email that Phil sent out and participate on Saturday and Sunday, the New Jersey CUSO party. And if we get a high score, we get a gavel from the whatever it is, the donor of the contest. So check your email for the New Jersey CUSO party this weekend and operate if you get a chance. That's my only comments and my only questions.
I think someone else had a comment in there. Who was that? Tony, I'll verify that it's 162, but I'm almost certain of it. I can't hit it from my driveway when I'm running between buildings. Oh, lucky, lucky. So, anyway, but I believe it's 162, whatever it is, 162.2. I think that's what it is. But I'll verify that somehow, or I'll look at my handy talkie or something on that. Anybody have any questions about the New Jersey CUSO party and what it's about? Maybe Tony would like to answer that question.
William, I was comment, and that is that members of the Bergen Amateur Radio Association, if you check your email, there are a list of the frequencies that they will be operating on, and the return call, what you should be replying, rather, either in CW or in and USB as the nature of information they require. But for instance, you'd indicate your county, and the abbreviation they're using for the county is BERG, Bergen, if you're sending code. But pronouncing Bergen is easy if you're on USB.
It is 162.2.
All right, very good.
Anybody else with comments for Tony about the New Jersey QFIL party? Okay, Tony, I guess that's all she wrote.
Very much.
Thank you, sir. Much obliged. It's a lot of fun. Alrighty. Let's see, our next question comes from our good friend Noel and Juliel. Good evening, Noel. What's on your mind?
You do know that if somebody was to suddenly get off work and turn on the radio, and the person who's in the control says, "And is there anybody else who hasn't checked in yet?" The person who just turned on the radio would not know that you were in the case. Okay, the question is, on a whole linear, such as an SB1000, which is 13500Z, and or an SB220, which has two 3500Zs, the question is, I noticed that when you're on 40 meters, the tuning is relatively broad. When you get up to 10 meters, you got to be, like, very careful with those dials because it's much, much sharper. I'm wondering what the reason for this is.
You found the tuning on which dials to be more sharp on 10 meters than lower frequencies?
Yeah, it appears that way.
Okay, let's think about that. So, a wavelength is a lot shorter at 10 meters than it is at, let's say, 80. Therefore, for a given kind of tuned circuit, you're likely to have a sharper null. If it's a low Q circuit, if it's a high Q circuit, then the lower frequency is going to be a lot sharper in order to get resonance, right?
Okay. I presume I have high Q circuits that they're nice large air capacitors and some really decent variable inductors.
And it's fun to hear on 10 meters than it is on 80.
And sharper on 10 meters.
Yeah, so it's probably a low Q circuit, but okay. All right. Well, there's your answer. Anybody want to make some comments on this? Well, you know, it's easy with a small change of capacitance or inductance to be further away from your resonant frequency pretty quickly. That's the reason for that. Do you have any other questions, Mr. Noel?
Yeah. Have you ever tried, or do you know of anybody that's ever tried to do so-called CCD antenna, which is basically a quarter wavelength antenna? For instance, if you had a metal surface such as the motorhome aluminum body, and they basically take this piece of tubing and they feed it, I believe, with a gamma match, and then at the very end of it, they put a variable capacitor. Do you know of anybody that actually has done one of those, other than the commercially available ones? For a while there, they had a 2-meter 440-220 that was set up in the form of a frisbee disc. Of course, the advantage of it's horizontally polarized. People were driving around doing side 10, 440-220 and 2 meters from their vehicle with a disc on the roof that looked like a frisbee. Do you know of anybody that's successfully done that for a larger antenna, say, you know, 20, 10, 50?
No, actually, I have not. It sounds like an intriguing exercise. I know people have done it for 6 and 2, and I've seen, I think, 10 and 6, or 10 or 6.
B2JEK.
Don, go right ahead.
This sounds like what they call a DDDR, Delta, Delta, Delta Romeo antenna, which is, just forget what the name is, it's a fancy name for the thing, and it's this piece of, they have made them for, some people have made them for, they tell you in the ARRL handbook, I think, you have this thing made, and like you said, it starts out at ground and goes around, there's a tap on it somewhere, and there's a capacitor at the ground. And you have a bunch of chicken wire as a ground plane, as a limited space antenna. So they are known, but I don't know anybody that's ever used one. Over.
Noel, or anybody else?
That was it. I was just curious.
The interesting thing about those antennas is that they are vertically polarized.
Oh, vertically. Oh, okay. So it's DDDR?
Right, triple DR, and while they look like they might be horizontal, they are in fact vertically polarized antennas.
No wonder I couldn't find it. Okay. They have a simulation and everything. Oh, neato. And how it works, build it for 2 meters. A 40-meter DDDR antenna on DX zone. Oh, thank you, Don. I was curious about that.
Well, there you go. Aren't you glad you asked?
Oh, we're on questions. One last little question. My SB-1000, a few months back, and I can't lift it. So finally we got into it with my friend Carlos a couple weeks back, and we turned it around, and he found it, got the fuses for me, and one of them had blown, and I looked at it, it was 10 amps. So naturally I had to RTFM, and when I did, it says, okay, if you run on 220, it takes 2 10-amp fuse, one in each leg. If you run it on 110, you're supposed to have 2 15-amp fuse. So obviously somebody converted from 220 to 110 and didn't bother changing the fuses. And of course the inrush current kicked it off when I turned it on that one time. So, two questions. I know what the advantages of putting a fuse in the ground leg of a mobile rig in case the main ground wire goes off the block. You don't try to start the engine with the wire that runs through your radio. What is the advantage of having 2 fuses in a rig like this? Because if the ground side blows, then is it possible that you still have something hot in there? The other thing is, does it make sense to use a smaller fuse and for more protection, or would you use the 15, or would you use the 10 time delay?
I don't think I'd use a delay fuse in a piece of, should we say, vulnerable electronics, period, number one. Number two, assuming your rig is grounded anyway, you have that opportunity to provide the ground path through the radio, which is why you have both a fuse on the power lead and also on the ground lead, as well as, depending on where it's situated, you might have one on the pigtail coming out of the radio before you connectorize it to go down the long line to the battery. And the reason for that is that in case something highly localized, you know, gets shorted, you'll pop that local fuse. The best bet to do is, if
have that one hot lead fuse that's near the radio be of a lower value but adequate value for the radio, and then have somewhat larger fuses on the main line and ground going out to your power source. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but what I'd have to do is put a 20-amp one on the ground lead and a 15-amp on the hot lead.
Yeah, you could do that. Absolutely could do that, because your radio's grounded, you're going to want to do something.
Well, that's assuming that we ground anything to anything.
My radio's be grounded, my friend. What can I tell you?
Speaking of grounding, at one of these flea markets, I bought 6-gauge wire that has grommets every 6 inches and covered with plastic, and it's meant to go through the ground screws. Would you run one wire from each piece of equipment to the common ground point? In my case, it's going to be the window plate. Or would you run one ground wire sort of meandering its way through to the ground point from 5 to 6 inches in one way and one from the next fridge shelf and one from the other direction and maybe have 1, 2, or 3 pieces hooked up to it?
Nope. I believe in a single point ground system so that you don't have dissimilar potentials for all the different radios. That's not a good thing. You don't want any, because there's already other wires among the different radios. So it's important to have as short a lead as possible from the backup of the electronics, not just radios, but electronics in general, to a single point ground. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I shouldn't have splurged on the expensive wire with the plastic coating and grommets every 6 inches. I should have just went to Home Depot, got some 6-gauge wire, and put end connectors on it. You know, the crimp quarter-inch hole in them so that I could just put it through the equipment screws.
Well, for RF, that's probably true, but for other things, it might be all right. So let me ask a question of you. What are you going to use the for? I mean, you could use it for something else. What am I trying to say? Oh, you could use it to tie your ground rods together. How long a piece do you have?
You're talking about the one with the holes in it? 25 feet. And it's got a grommet every 6 inches. And the picture that they drew was, you started, for instance, on the left side of your ham's bench and worked your way through the equipment one by one until you hit the ground plate.
Well, then the answer is that you could certainly use it to bond your ground rods together. I have that 2-inch webbing that is popular, and it's insulated, and I'm in the process of taking that webbing braid that's insulated and periodically bonding it to ground rods and making sure that each one of the various ground rods along the one side of the house are actually all bonded together. And I'm about to pound at least one, maybe two more ground rods, so that every 8 or 10 feet, you don't want them any closer, by the way, are in fact grounded together or bonded together. And that makes a ground field that's pretty contiguous. And I'm going to go everywhere from the back tower, past the service ground in the backyard, past the
housings for the central air to the to the central air to the ones on the tower, and then there are two, one for the service and one for, I think it might be an old one from when I had cable. There's one there as well, or maybe it's one from the power service and one for the telephone. But the point is that, bond them all together, and that way, for like 60 feet or so, I will have a contiguous ground field. So that will essentially make my circle of ground potential very, very big. And while it doesn't wrap around the entire house, it will certainly be a lot better than what's there now, which is pretty good, by the way. I've got several of them bonded together already.
Well, what I did is I have two down one side of the house and a couple down the other side and one out, and each one is individually wired with a 6-gauge bare copper wire, which is down 6 or 8 inches down in the ground. And by doing that, hopefully I have some of the ground to it, I guess the copper wire will help. Of course, it's coated by now with black wood oxide.
Well, that brings up another question, and that is, how did you bond the wire, this number 6 wire, to the ground rod? And the answer is you probably used a clamp, and then you buried it in the dirt. I leave mine in the air just above the ground, and periodically I open them all up, hose them with some sort of conductive crapola, and tighten them back down again.
I use that Permatex, whatever the heck it's called. It's when you do aluminum to copper connections and wiring. It's got little particles of zinc, and it's a silicone grease. And you shake up the bottle, and you put it on the connections. And when you squeeze it down, supposedly it forces the air out, and the little particles of zinc cut into the clamp and cut into whatever make a good connection. And I don't like to use silicone because it gives off vinegar vapors, acetic acid. I prefer to use Goop, which is 100% carcinogenic aromatic hydrocarbons. Probably would rip out your lungs, too, if you did it in the house. Whenever I do something with Goop, I always take it outside and let it dry. I'm afraid when you read the label, this is going to rip out your lungs, cause cancer and impotence all at the same time. Back to that. This is it, Julio.
Well, kids, you made a concern. Do you really care at this point about impotence? Could be doing you a favor. Right, you can ignore that. I'm good with that. We're just getting into the driveway here. I am pleased and proud to report. I think the general view here is that we should look at the idea of putting up, making sure that bonding is really good. You don't want to develop a problem. Some people actually use these heat welding things. They're like a chemical weld where you basically combine two things and it gets all hot and actually fuses the metals between the ground strap and the ground rod. Pretty impressive to look at. It's basically the same kind of technology they use to fuse continuous rail together. Except in this case, it's not steel, it's copper. Any other comments on this? Well, then let us move on. Where else do we go from here? Noel, do you want any more?
Well, as you know, I couldn't get into the crawl space in my basement, even though we did enlarge the window opening several years ago to make it approximately 3 feet square instead of being 15 inches high by 3 feet wide. And we helped our friend Ben get down there to go shopping in our supplies. And over the years, every time I had brought another ground rod connector in with 6-gauge wire, I had one of my friends go down there, my friend Carlos, and connect it to the main upright water pipe. It's 3/4-inch copper that comes in off the street, figuring that's the earth ground. Plus, that's the one the power company chose. It seems that I have to really go look at the workmanship once in a while. It was nicely done. When I went down there, I found 7 copper wires coming in from various directions, nicely connected to this pipe with 7 clamps. You know how big those clamps are? I could have easily put 3 6-gauge wires in one of the screws on the outside instead of having 7 different clamps. So that was my amusing story of the day.
So you're set up for the next 14 wires. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. Another 14 ground wires.
Wow. You'll probably be a 50,000 watt AM broadcast station before you know it. Excellent. Excellent. Anybody else have comments about grounding? Alrighty. No, I don't think we have any more.
Oh, you're going to have to think of something on yourself.
Well, we do have Charlie with another question. Before we go to Charlie, we are going to go to Charlie next, but are there any other check-ins for the net? This is KTBA or W2TTT. Okie dokie. Well, then, let's move on. Mr. Charlie, W2R, KTBA or W2TTT.
Okay, thanks, Gordon, WE2R. My question involves my deep cycle marine battery, which I stored away on my porch outside last fall and didn't touch it till today when I decided to, I need it now. So I decided to put a charge on it, and before I did that, I put a voltmeter on it, read 3 volts. And it's sitting on the charger now, a low amp charger. So I'm wondering if I killed the battery by leaving it out all winter without any charge on it, or I seriously weakened the battery. If I did, I'll just have to buy a new one. Back to that, WE2R.
Unless I'm going to be pleasantly surprised, the answer to your question is yes, you toasted it.
Okay. Sure. Easy question, easy answer.
Yeah, not even enough time to get a mouthful of ice cream. Yeah, that's a problem. So, let me tell you that I'm now the proud possessor of an Optima Blue D34, I think it is. It's their largest deep cycle marine battery. And, boy, what a neat battery that is. There's a reason why they charge so much for those damn things. They're very impressive. Sorry to hear about your battery. I'm actually running a solar charging project here and, having a ball doing it. We built our own telemetry device, a bunch of us at work, and software to go with it, and it's busily chirping off to a server in the great beyond. The status of the charging, the status of the discharging, etc. It's really kind of neat. So, some other projects, I'm sure, kicking around here over the next couple of months and years. about. So anybody else with a topic related to batteries, deep cycle batteries, charging, etc. Charlie, just curious of one thing. Did you have it on concrete or macadam?
On suede.
You know, just as bad. You literally can watch a battery self-destruct by doing that. Anything that's not thoroughly, and I mean thoroughly insulated from the ground, that includes things like moisture. So a piece of wood, while better, is not as good as, you know, the open air, but you got to get it away from any kind of ground path, because just basically electrostatically it will slowly discharge itself and kill it.
Can I take any comfort from the fact that we had a warm winter?
Jim. I think the answer is no.
All right. Well, I got 6 years out of it. I guess that's pretty good.
I'll go spend $1 billion on an Optima blue top D34.
Where do you get such a battery, and how big is it?
About the size of any other car battery. The top geometry is the same, but it's got 6 cylinders. But you want, I think, the blue top for your application. Look up Optima blue top batteries. Just Google that, Optima blue top.
Yeah, okay, I will. Thanks, Gordon. WE2R.
Yeah, I fully intend over the next couple of months to have a couple of sessions of the TechNet run off that power supply. It's just right now we're running it through a different regime where it's got a specific charge discharge profile, only augmented or changed, I should say, by the weather. And the amount of energy we get from the sun. So when we're done with that, shall we say, set of tests for over a period of the next couple of weeks, maybe a month or so, then what we will do is we'll find out what we're going to do with it next. Go with it.
Is this work-related or fun-related?
Mercifully both. They pay, I play.
Okay, very good. Actually, you know, my need is very minimal. It's for the boat, and it runs an automatic bilge pump, which hopefully doesn't run very often. A couple of lights. I'm probably going to switch over to the LED lights. So I don't really need much.
Get the Optima. That way you can put a radio on the boat and be done with it.
All right, I'll check that out.
Yeah, I think the D34 is their biggest one. And it's like a sturdy car battery, something major. It's just the top form factor is the same. But their cells are cylindrical. So in order to make room, they're actually offset with respect to each other, kind of like under a two diagonal but parallel rows. All righty. Again, it was Optima blue top is what you'd want. And what do you call it? That was one of my contributions to the system analysis, was to do the battery selection. And also, I helped with the power budget for the panel that we chose to. Which is a small 2 foot square, roughly speaking, 50 watt panel. Crystalline panel, you know, blue crystalline panel. And it's now bolted above my pergola in my backyard. 13 feet in the air. It works great. Facing south, southwest. It's all good. Alrighty. Anybody else on charging batteries, etc.? J. Don, go ahead.
You say the battery's toasted, but is it possible to get any usage out of it at all for a low current drain device? I was thinking of the battery for a QRP rig or something like that. I mean, not for, you wouldn't expect it to be a motor. If it's designed to start a motor or run a bilge pump, I realize it pulls some current, but something else lighter and usage, not something I would put my life dependency on a boat, but something for a home over.
Well, it's probably got a shredded cell or more. So the real question is, what voltage can you get it back up to? And then, how much charge can you apply to each of the viable cells? And relatively speaking, how viable are they? A lot of those cells have probably developed little whiskers across the plates. And so to the extent that they haven't shorted, the thing is alive. But the question is, can you cook those little crystals that are growing toward each other off and restore some of the capacity? That's the question. Because those little whiskers, as they get proximity to the opposite plate, diminish the amount of stored charge that you're capable of storing.
I get you. Okay, very good. Thank you.
You know, sometimes I don't. I just gave you an answer that was factually accurate, but I don't know where I pulled that from. All right, well, anybody else with battery questions or charging questions?
My friend left on my four-way flashers in my electric scooter, and when we found it 3 months later, the battery voltage was 2 volts. Never was able to charge it back up.
Yeah, those are SLAs, and probably stored in a reasonable place, so you're very fortunate. Who was the other station with, Noel? All right. Anybody have any follow-on to Noel? Noel, do you have any follow-on to you?
I turned them in as cores and bought new ATMs. $260. Anyways, capacity is higher, and I installed, by the way, you can go to Harbor Freight, and for about $7, you can get a 400-amp disconnect switch that's made to disconnect the car battery, and I install that in, and the rule is now whenever we put the scooter away, we pull the disconnect switch and disconnect the batteries.
That sounds a really good idea. So Harbor Freight has a device with this, a 400 amp disconnect switch, huh? I found some 150 volt ones or watt amp ones in the auto parts store, and I bought a 60 for my mobile ham shack here, which I have yet to install. But that sounds pretty good.
The contacts are just basically a humongous piece of copper. It's actually very well built for Harbor Freight junk. I'm very happy with it. It has very, very low resistance. It's hard to tell what the resistance is because the test leads have so much more resistance. Anyways, I got to get going. K2BR, this is Atulio.
All right, very good. Very, very good. Alrighty, any other stations with comments tonight? Okay, well, let me take a moment here. Last Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday was the Passaic County Fair, and there were several radio amateurs who came out and helped with managing that. I want to say, while the CERT people and the God knows the Sheriff's Department goes all out, and the Passaic County Sheriff's Fire Team, Search and Rescue Team, are also present, I got to tell you,
backbone of the communications, no matter where people came, or backbone of everything, no matter what organization they were in, that really held that event together were the amateur radio operators. Even if they were in some food chain elsewhere, they provided a communications path and a cadre of understanding and operability that was just phenomenal. Among others, besides into a K2MPH, you know, Mike Hoft, who was the senior officer in charge for most of the event. We had N3UXK, and we had my wife Nancy, and tons of others came by and lent a hand to that event. And what was instructive about it was that you had essentially five operational periods that were a little longer than most. Some of them were as long as 12 hours. And they were successive. So it was really, really good training. And, you know, it's not what you do on day one and day two. It's how do you improve on it in day two, three, four, and five. And how do you deal with the fact that you're running low on energy and things like that on days three, four, and five. And, you know, how does your training kick in to make it all work? And I found myself even very, very blessed with that. So it was a very, very good training should there be a major disaster. So I encourage folks to participate in these things. August 19th will be the Ravapo Rally. Hopefully others will want to participate. And we also, on August 11th, Saturday, we have a ham fest, and we have two unbelievably great good guest speakers. Let me drop it. One is our own Joyce Birmingham and Bill Heitzik. Bill Heitzik is actually going to talk about the W2QSL Bureau and some other matters related to the league. And the other is, of course, I'm sure Joyce is going to have a speaking period too to answer questions about the league as well. So keep that in mind. And then Rich Moseson is going to talk about how the maker movement in, you know, if you ever see these maker fairs, how plugging amateur radio into maker fairs is how we're going to ensure the future of amateur radio in all sorts of ways, both whimsical and also purposeful ways. We'll see a lot of interesting things through those folks. So keep that in mind. And August 11th, Saturday, will be a wonderful hamfest in Bergenfield, and for the benefit of the scouts and Venture Crew 7373. And of course, then a week after that on Sunday is the Ravapo Rally. We'd love to have your help for that day event, for all or part of the day. Anyway, any other questions, comments, confusions? Okay, well, next Sunday, a week from this Sunday, not this weekend, but next weekend, will be the next Barra meeting. It'll be 7 o'clock in the Washington Township Municipal Building. Gather about 7 p.m. on Sunday, and we'll start the meeting about 7:30. Anyway, wish everybody a fine day. Thank you for participating in the event. I'd like to thank the Chestnut Ridge Radio Club for the use of the repeater. This is KTBAR W2TTT, returning the repeater to normal amateur radio use. Night night, everybody. W2TTT.
CX6CAH disconnected.